supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Work for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we often hear on the news about violence and prejudice, but that's just the fallout from hatred. What we don't hear about is what happens before that, how it starts, what are the building blocks, why we hate in the first place, and where the ideas come from. Today on Voices in the Family, we'll be discussing that and how and if hate and prejudice can be overcome. My guests are Nilanjana Dasgupta, an associate professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts, who studies prejudice and stereotyping and what can be done to overcome it. We'll also hear from a recovering skinhead, Frank Mink. But first we'll hear from Richard Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which in the decades since its founding has shut down some of the nation's most dangerous hate groups by winning multi-million dollar jury verdicts on behalf of their victims. First of all, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Your work has always been difficult, tracking hate groups.
Yes.
It's gotten much worse.
Absolutely.
Over the last, what, decade, Richard?
The last decade has been a real challenging one for us. We've seen a growth in hate groups from about 600 to over 900, more than a 50% increase.
Why?
I think the major factor is the furor over immigration, the changing demographics of our nation. In 1970, when you and I were young, Dan, less than one in five persons in our country was non-white. Today, that figure's doubled. Demographers tell us that it'll be a majority-minority country, or there'll be a new majority in 2050. And people are reacting poorly to that, I'm afraid.
When I've heard you talk recently, you talk about hate crimes against minorities,
yes.
Latinos specifically.
Been a big increase in hate crimes against Latinos over the last decade at the same time that the number of hate groups has risen. You know, you see things like the crime in Patchogue, Long Island, the Suffolk County thing, where those kids went out beaner jumping and killed an Ecuadorian immigrant. You know, a lot of ugly crimes, I'm afraid.
What is beaner jumping?
Beaner jumping was their term for going out and hunting Mexicans. It was just the term that they used. Other factors that are kind of roiling the hate movement now, two in particular, the president. The face of the government is black now, and that doesn't sit well with a lot of people. And then, of course, the economy. It's tough out there for so many people, and these are times when people, you know, start looking for answers, and the white supremacists out there are saying, we're the answer. Then, of course, also we've seen this big growth, about a 250% growth in the last year alone in the number of these kind of conspiratorial-minded anti-government patriot groups.
Well, in the Bible, there's a phrase that says, you shall imbue the head of a goat with all the sins of the people.
I did not know that, Dan.
Well, that's the origin of the scapegoat.
I did not know
that. And then you banish the goat forever. So in addition to looking for answers, we tend to look for causes. And in Germany and in this country, it was the Jews, and now it's the Latinos, and 50 years ago, and to a certain extent today, it's the blacks.
Yeah, I wouldn't underestimate the impact of anti-Semitism today. I don't think Jews as individuals are so much at risk, but what I do think is that anti-Semitism still animates so much of the hate movement. People see Obama, for example. David Duke argues that Obama is a visual aid for white people. And what he means by that is that Obama is living proof that the nefarious Jew has stolen their government.
I want to talk about hate crimes in Pennsylvania. When we think about hate crimes or hate groups, we usually think about the South.
Yes.
but it's pretty bad here in Pennsylvania.
Well, Pennsylvania certainly has its fair share. By our last count, we found about 28 hate groups in Pennsylvania. Hate groups of all stripes.
And that number has increased also.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
There's another phenomenon that's happened here very recently, and it's called flash mobs.
I've heard about that.
It just occurred here in Pennsylvania, and it's a group of generally kids who just go up and beat somebody up spontaneously. And I wonder if that categorizes as a hate crime. I mean, it's not necessarily planned, but it's an act of hatred just against another human being.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know enough about it. I mean, we characterize hate crimes that are committed on the basis of immutable characteristics like race or religion or sexual orientation. These sound more like thrill crimes to me. Kids who lead lives of, they feel powerless until they get into a big group. And then, you know, they go out and mayhem results.
You talked about powerlessness. I want to address the kind of the psychological underpinnings of hatred. It is about lack of education. It's about powerlessness. It's about being vulnerable to someone who promises salvation.
That's exactly right. People are looking for answers, especially in kind of our global spinning economy. You know, and people are looking for connections with the world. You know, sometimes we say that Klansmen would have been good bowlers rather than good cross burners if the bowling team had called them before the Ku Klux Klan.
Hmm. So that raises the question, what can be done? What needs to be done?
Well, first, I think that adults need to talk civilly. When all the adults are screaming at one another, it's hard to teach kids to be civil to one another. Secondly, I think we have to work very, very hard in our schools to remind people of the values of democracy, teach people how to have respectful dialogues, teach them the history of our country, because people just don't know this. And, you know, over time, you know, King said that the moral arc of the universe may be long, but it bends towards justice. And we believe that. I think we're going to go through some rocky times, but ultimately, as a people, we'll get there.
I want to push you here, because everything you said sounded great, and it was all very abstract. I mean, when you say parents have to behave differently, that's all well and good, but they don't. And all parents are not, I mean, the tools I have are psychotherapy. I mean, send a couple angry, arguing parents into me and I'll be able to help them. But what do we do as a
group? Maybe this radio program is kind of group psychotherapy, Dan.
Maybe. I hope it is.
I don't want to pretend that things are easy. You know, Robert Putnam, the author of Bowling Alone, recently did a study, and what he found was that the more diverse communities become, the less trusting they become. Not just trust toward people who are different, but trust toward people who are the same. And he said it brings out the turtle in all of us. We kind of hunker down. And what we need to do, of course, is open our public spaces, reconnect with people, not just kind of people who are like us, but people who are different. And there have to be lots, we have to promote lots of forums, lots of public spaces to kind of make that happen, to let people know one another and to kind of build trust. There's not going to be a secret formula. I do think that our political leaders have a lot of responsibility in the bully pulpit. Unfortunately, they have people whose goal it is to rip people apart rather than try to, you know, kind of solve the country's problems.
And I think that goes on across the political spectrum, where it's all character assassination and very little anymore about content. You know, this need for us to create community, to get to know one another. My concern is the technology is taking us in the other way. First of all, the 24-hour news cycle and so many cable channels that people tend to turn on the news that will affirm their own beliefs, and they won't learn anything new. And now we've got social networking online. So we're not making eye contact with people, and we're not really hearing their stories. There's a website that I know you're very much aware of, the Stormfront.
Yes.
Website. This is an example of where people go to get their anger stoked, to get their beliefs reinforced, and this is how people get involved in doing harmful things. There's a lot of people involved in that website.
No question about it. Probably about 145,000 registered users on Stormfront. And on the home page, they have a special section for the Keystone State, unfortunately. The use of the internet is a two-sided phenomenon. In some sense, it gives people access to a hate group that they would never have otherwise. Kids might go to Stormfront, but they wouldn't be caught dead at a white supremacist rally. So it increases that connection. On the other hand, people get their daily dose of hate perhaps at home, on the net, and then don't act on it kind of out in the world. So I think that the jury is out as to exactly how the internet promotes real hate groups and activity in this country.
What are you doing about schools?
Well, we have a program called Teaching Tolerance, and what we do is, because of our strong donor base, we send free classroom materials to every school in America that asks for them. We have a magazine called Teaching Tolerance that goes out twice a year that tries to give the wit and wisdom of the profession. What are the great programs that are out there to help kids get along? We also put out teaching kits about the civil rights movement because we think, you know, that's such a quintessentially American movement and such an important movement. These teaching kits are anchored by good documentary films, 40 minutes. Four have been nominated for Academy Awards, two have won Oscars, and we send it all free of charge to any school out there that's listening can get one.
How?
Just go to the Southern Poverty Law Center's website, splcenter.org, go to the Teaching Tolerance section, and follow the ordering information.
When we think of hate crimes, we think of the skinheads with the tattoo on their forehead. Is that the face of hate crimes today?
Unfortunately, it's not. You know, you wish you could say it was confined to the skinhead with the tattoo, but the hate crimes are much more likely to be committed by people who look like our neighbors. Those kids in Long Island that killed Marcelo Lucero, they were high school students, some good high school students who were just bored, drunk, and, you know, kind of going down the wrong path. I think the kids in Shenandoah, you know, they were tough ethnic kids, but, you know, they were people's sons and daughters, and they had decent lives ahead of them, and things got out of hand. So
I've watched these kids cry when they were convicted.
Yes.
It's almost like they didn't know what they were doing when they were doing it, which is typical of the adolescent brain.
I think that that's right. There's also this group mentality. When people get together in groups, kind of the IQ level, unfortunately, goes down geometrically by the number of people who are there.
I've got a question that I think is critical but might be unreasonable. What can I do as an individual?
Well, you know, each of us has a circle of friends, a circle of acquaintances at work, at home, in the community. And I think all of us just have an obligation to try to widen that circle, to promote understanding in our workplace, promote understanding in our places of worship. I think there are lots of small acts every day that one can take where one reaches across the aisle and makes the world a better place.
So, similar to what Gandhi said with his famous quote now about you must be the change you wish to see in the world.
He took that from me, actually.
He did.
Yeah, and also, of course, you know, Robert Kennedy gave a great speech in South Africa, in Cape Town, during the era of apartheid. And he talked about how it was through the numberless small acts that the great torrent would occur and wipe down the mighty walls of oppression. So I think it's those same things. I think the one thing I think it's really important is for people not to forget that they have the power to change the world in those small steps. Nowadays, people feel so powerless. There's nothing that they can do. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, unfortunately. So, you know, everyone needs to go out and do what they can. And if everyone does what they can do, the world will be a better place.
Kindness cures hatred.
I think that's well put.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dan,
for
being here.
More important, thank you for the work you do. That was Richard Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, talking about how we can overcome prejudice and hate. Coming up next, we'll hear from Frank Mink about his life as a recovering skinhead. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM.
Christiana Care's Helen F. Graham Cancer Center, a National Cancer Institute selected community cancer center, supports WHYY. The Graham Cancer Center offers a team approach to cancer care, access to clinical trials, and personal care coordinators who guide patients throughout treatment. The Graham Center, a contributor to the National Institutes of Health's Cancer Genome Atlas Project, has expanded its facility on the Christiana Hospital campus in Newark, Delaware. Full details at christianacare.org/cancer.
I don't think Bauer's just looking to expose the Russians' involvement in the plot against his son. This guy's out for blood.
Time has run out for Jack Bauer, the hero of Fox TV's 24. Monday is the final episode. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the show's executive producer, Howard Gordon. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about hate today, why we hate, how it starts, and how hate and prejudice can be overcome. Growing up in Philadelphia, Frank Mink had a tough childhood and fell into the skinhead movement as a teen. Years of hatred and violence landed him in prison, which is where he eventually changed his ways. Our executive producer, Mike and Scott, spoke with Mink about his new book, Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead.
Frank, talk about how you first became attracted to the skinhead movement.
I went from my South Philly neighborhood to up to Southwest Philadelphia, and I had to go to the local public school, which was called Pepper Middle School. And it just wasn't a good place for a new white kid to go. It was just a lot of fights. I mean, you had to watch yourself a lot. There was groups of black kids that would look for white kids sometimes walking home or going to the trolleys or in the bathrooms by themselves. It was just a horrible little place to go for me that year. And then that summer, I went up to Lancaster, Pennsylvania area, where some of my South Philly family had moved up there. He was up there, my cousin, and he was a skinhead. So he was going through phases in life, and this was one of his phases. And I was attracted to it due to the fact they would ask me about what it was like going to school in Philadelphia. I can honestly tell you that when I came home from school, either in my mom's house or my dad's house, I never was asked, how was school today? And the skinheads used to always say, man, what's it like going to school in Philly? And to me, that felt like someone was asking me, how's your life? How you doing?
So it was more about somebody actually caring about you?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's the same thing with all gangs. I mean, I was, even though I had the tough time at Pepper Middle School, I was one of those kids that was just a shooken up soda bottle waiting for someone to unleash the top and point directions that they wanted the spray to go. I could have been a left-wing gorilla in Columbia right now. Who knows, you know? Anyone could have recruited me, and that's what goes on with gangs and that type of stuff.
Give us a little bit of background about your childhood. Your parents were very young when they had you. Their marriage didn't last, and you really had a lot of difficult situations in your home life.
To give my mom justice, she tried her best, I think, in the beginning. When it was just me and her, after she left my dad, my mom moved back to her Irish neighborhood and down 2nd Street. And I kind of just tried to assume that. My mom had some boyfriends off and on him throughout my life, and she finally got one that she wound up marrying, and he was just not a good person. And this is every person in my life that knew or know him. He's passed on now, but I will tell you, he just wasn't a really nice person. And he hated my guts. Even when I was a 10, 11-year-old kid, he just hated me, and he would tell everybody that, and he would hit me, and he always degraded me in front of people. I mean, it was just a horrible, horrible way to live. You know, then I went to go with my dad, who, you know, basically lived his life in a bar. And
So there was a lot of anger inside you even before you got to that middle school.
Yeah. I mean, I don't believe there was anger until the stepfather came along. Like, I remember always being a good kid, and my family will tell me that too, like, as I wrote the book, and they always say, I remember before John came along, you were just a good, polite little kid, you know?
Now, you talked about when you met your first group of skinheads in Lancaster County. When did your real indoctrination start with the information that you later internalized?
It probably started within the year, 2 years. There was a couple older skinheads that would take me up and took me to Bible studies, and I would learn, you know, how to hate through the Bible, and got more militant. And now the hatred for Jews was more than the others. You know, if you had to categorize who you hated more, you know, now there was and I didn't know any Jews, so it was easy for me to hate them. You know, they would tell me stuff like the Federal Reserve is run by Israel, and the American Jews run the Federal Reserve. I'm a 14, 15 year old kid. Okay, that sounds good to me. You know, I don't know.
So you came back to Philadelphia. You were hanging out on South Street a lot in those days. You started a crew of other kids who were also skinheads. And you guys fought a lot. You drank a lot. You partied a lot. And you basically rumbled. How did you make the connection with the indoctrination, your hatred for Jewish people, and then just the street fighting that you did? Did that all fit together in your head somehow?
It's sad to say, but I felt that we were practicing, or we were just the wrath of God on the less fortunate humans who weren't as good as, you know, not even just the white race, but people that didn't believe what we believed was our enemy. So it could have been any group. And sometimes we just took our anger out on homeless people. So sometimes we'd do stupid stuff like that, and other days we'd go and gay bash and cause trouble.
And did it offer you any kind of relief for the bottled up feelings that you felt inside after you had one of these violent fights with somebody?
I could tell you that, you know, every kick and punch sometimes felt really good. It felt good to be on that end of the butt whoopings, you know, from my stepfather beating the crap. So I don't want to make it an excuse for that's why we were doing this stuff, but for me it felt good. You got to know, I was an egomaniac with low self-esteem. I mean, that's all I was, and you put alcohol on top of that, and I was one of the most dangerous human beings because of that.
Talk a bit about how things spun out of control more and more. As you got older, you drank more, you got more violent, you got involved in more criminal activity.
You know, as much as we wanted to be these beacon of the white race, I mean, we weren't. We were thugs and criminals. And yeah, I mean, I wound up having to go across, I mean, I had to run. I had to get out of Philadelphia. I was wanted in questioning for some things in Philly, Delaware, New Jersey, like South Jersey. I mean, I was like a tri-state kind of guy. And so I got in trouble in all these places, so I took off. You know, I really was basically a leader there. I started my own cable access show for being a skinhead. Me and another guy did. And we would recruit people, and, you know, we used the media to recruit people. I mean, we had this whole plan down. And then there was a non-racist skinhead who kind of hung around with us, and we had some dealings with him. And those dealings had gone south, and they were criminal dealings, and it was time for him to go, we thought. So we videotaped the kidnapping, and that's what I went to prison for.
And then what happened in prison?
You know, the first thing that happened was, you know, I really was going to God on my own. You know, born and raised very Irish Catholic, I had this different God, and maybe I'm wrong, and I know there's great people that have great Catholic beliefs, but I had this Catholic belief that when I stubbed my toe as a little kid and I tell my grandma, how I stubbed my toe, she'd say, well, God punished you. And I'll say, but I didn't do anything. Well, he knows you're going to do something. But I always had this punishing God. And then I believed in a God who hated, and my job was to have justice for him. So now I go to God all on my own, and I'm reading the Bible and in prison all by myself because I was in the hole for a long time. Like, I wasn't truly ready to turn my will and my life over to a higher power. I was more just saying, please, God, help me out of this situation, like a foxhole prayer. But I would read the Bible, and God started proving to me he existed. So I started going to Bible studies, and then I started playing football with some black guys when I got upstate, and I played some basketball, and I still hung with my Aryan friends. I never thought I was going to ever get out of this movement. I just played a lot of sports because I was a 17, 18-year-old kid in an adult prison upstate who wanted to just run a little bit more. And what happened was when I got released, I looked back on a lot of the relationships I had in there, and I happened to be closer to guys who weren't my color because we had the same age situation going on. We were all young. So, like, I started to reflect on things like that. And that's one of the things that started to change me. I got back to Philadelphia when I got released from prison. And one of the things, and this is kind of funny, was helped me change, was O.J. Simpson. I started hearing about this DNA thing. I never heard of it before. And here it's talking about how we all have the same strand except for one, which makes us different as humans. And then we're all just one strand away from being a gorilla. You know, so I started looking at that.
And how did that feel when that world that you had constructed for yourself, that firm belief system, when that started to crumble, what did that do to you, to your personality?
Well, when I first started getting out of the movement, here's kind of a funny thing. I still was going to hold on to this hatred for Jews, so I could still kind of say I was still kind of right. Like, I didn't want to admit I was wrong. I mean, even with all this being showed, it was hard for me to say, wow, the stuff I really believed in and fought for is all completely wrong. So I still held on to this belief that the Jews were evil. So I'm home, I have a swastika tattooed on my neck, I have tattoos on my head and my fingers. I mean, when I go fill out a job application, these aren't good people skills. So people aren't hiring me. And a Jewish guy gives me a job working at an antique warehouse, and he's a very Jewish guy. I mean, he's at a yeshiva all the time, and he didn't care that I was a Nazi. He was like, I don't care, just don't break my furniture, that's all I care. And the guy just showed me everything about the antique world. He was just I thought of him as this great business and street smart guy, had a kind of a tough life and made this business. And I used to always do something because I truly felt it. If I made a mistake, deep down inside me, I always think it's because I'm stupid. I just did. And I would always say that, oh, I'm so stupid. And Keith, one day, they just said, don't say that. You're the most street smartest person I know. Why do you think I have kept you on in my company? Why do you think I love working with you? And he gave me this pep talk, and here he's giving me this pep talk, and I think he's the street smartest guy from making this business. And I still had this hatred for Jews at the time. And I remember just looking over at him, and he's giving me this little life pep talk about how smart I am. And all the time I keep looking down at my boots I had, at my Doc Martens on with my red laces, and I was just so embarrassed. Just so embarrassed. And that day he dropped me off, and that was the day I said I was done.
From your experience, what are some good ways to prevent the kind of experience that you had in your life, to prevent hatred, prejudice, violence, and or maybe to help kids or grown-ups overcome those feelings?
Well, first thing is, if we're going to start with the kids, what I do now, one of my main stands, I guess, is if someone says a racist joke and it's in front of my children, I will stop them right away. I would say that's not acceptable. I don't care if you say it in front of me. I'm an adult. I can make my own decision, and I will not laugh at their joke if, you know. But so that's the first thing. So now I'm setting grounds that, you know, this is unacceptable. The second thing is if you know you're okay with your children and your children respect you, they're usually not going to get into this stuff because they're going to trust their dad and mom. Even when a 16-year-old who thinks they know it all, if they come home and they're getting involved in the skinheads and both their mom and dad are like, you're not getting into this, this is not going to be spiritually conducive or conducive to what you want to achieve in life, most kids are going to get out of it. It's the kids that don't have good parent settings that are going to get into this.
That was our executive producer, Mike and Scott, speaking with Frank Mink about his life and his new book, Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. Coming up, we'll continue to talk about overcoming prejudice and hatred with Nilanjana Dasgupta, an associate professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Orchestra, performing a concert of Mozart and Strauss, June 4th through 8th at the Kimmel Center. Under the baton of chief conductor Charles Dutoit, the fabulous Philadelphians perform Strauss's Don Juan and Don Quixote. Also featured is Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 5 in A Major. Tickets and information for the Philadelphia Orchestra at 215-893-1999 or online at philorc.org.
When segregation was the law of the land, education for African Americans was an afterthought in many places. One exception, the Bordentown School in New Jersey.
They nurtured us, they cuddled us, and they kicked us in the butt when it was necessary.
A new documentary explores Bordentown and our country's history of educational disparities. We'll talk with the director next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about hatred today. Why we hate, how it starts, more important, how it can be overcome. We'll now talk with Nilanjana Dasgupta. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts. You do a lot of research about stereotypes. The reality is we kind of need our stereotypes, don't we?
Yeah, because the stereotypes kind of help us differentiate us from them, which is something that Meek talks about in this interview and also talks about in his book, which I read, that stereotypes allow us to define who we are and how we are different from whoever they are. And so when he meets this Jewish employer who breaks all his stereotypes, he is kind of dissolving those boundaries, which can be tough.
Frightening.
Yeah, exactly.
Your research, I mean, what we hear in Frank Meek and what we hear in the news media are these very obvious, dangerous, lethal stereotypes. Mm-hmm. We almost hear them in politics now. But your research is also about very subtle stereotypes mm-hmm. that are not quite so visible. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. When we think about stereotypes and prejudice, we think of hate, bigotry, animus, things that are very overt and in your face. And that is very real. But in addition to that, it's easy to overlook the other kind, which is much more subtle, lives in all of us, which is the assumptions that we have about different groups of people that kind of passively get encoded in our mind just because we live in a stratified hierarchical society where we see that some groups are associated with good things and other groups are associated with bad things. And simply that mere observation almost kind of gets imprinted in our mind. So when somebody asks us how we feel about group X or group Y, we say what our conscious values are. But when we are not so aware, those unconscious or automatic associations may show up in our attitudes and sometimes in our behavior in a split second.
So you're not saying that stereotypes are good or bad. They are facts.
They are learned associations. So whether they are facts or not depends on, you know, our definition of objective reality. Sometimes our version of reality are the people we know or the media we watch or what our friends tell us. But all of those create these associations between group X and good or group Y and bad. And that then becomes our reality.
And some of this grouping is adaptive, yes? I mean, I see somebody carrying a gun and who's not wearing a policeman's uniform, and I get nervous.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. So these associations develop because we encounter so much information in a day, in a moment, that we have to have some shortcuts, some what we call heuristics, some mental shortcuts that allow us to pick up bits of information and act on it quickly. The problem is, just as that's a flexible part of the human mind, it can also lead to errors, biases in thinking. So in a split second, assuming that this person with a puffy jacket has a gun in his jacket rather than is unarmed can lead us sometimes to make a judgment that he's dangerous and we might shoot him preemptively. And that would be, you know, kind of the prototypical dramatic case of something where an assumption can lead to an error that's sometimes fatal.
So we know now that stereotypes are part of our hardwiring. They're almost inevitable. We know they can be fostered, of course, by parents and by the larger community. And you know, we can't talk about stereotyping without talking about the new immigration law mm-hmm. in Arizona that makes it legal for for police to stop people and ask for papers if they just look foreign. So a government could foster stereotyping too.
Yeah, I think stereotypes, you know, so stereotypes, I wouldn't call them hardwired, but I would say that they are very rapidly learned without our awareness. And so sometimes governments foster it, sometimes certain kinds of media foster it. Sometimes we just learn it by observing what our friends and peers say, much like Frank Meek's experience. What his peers said is how he got into the movement in the first place. So I think the Arizona law is a great example of a situation where people's observation of what someone looks like leads to automatic assumptions about whether they are legal or not, which may be completely wrong. They may be correct, but they also may be wrong. And just judging someone by their appearance and making assumptions based on that kind of violates the kind of fundamental American principle of judging each person as a person.
So tell us when stereotypes morph into hatred.
That's a good question. I think it all starts with a fundamental core need to belong that we as all human beings have. And there's a lot of research showing that as social animals, people have certain fundamental needs, and this need to belong to a community or a group is one of them. And how we define our community and our group kind of depends on who is around us, whether we define this group broadly as more inclusive or narrowly as more exclusive. Frank Meek's example of, you know, going to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and encountering his cousin who had become a neo-Nazi, become a skinhead, that's how he got into it, because those are the people that became his community. So I think that this fundamental need to belong means that any group of people we attach to ourselves becomes imbued with positive qualities. That group becomes good. So us equals good. And any group or any community we don't belong to, that we differentiate ourselves from, becomes associated with not good and sometimes with bad. And that's the place where simple categorization of us and them takes on meaning, takes on value, takes on good and bad qualities, and that's the beginning of prejudice.
Mm. We are seeing this every day in our public dialogue more and more. But you're talking about prejudice, and I want to push it a little further.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about hatred.
Okay.
When and how does it turn to hatred? As a clinician, as a psychologist, it can't just be a function of the external group we join. There's got to be something internally that we bring into it, or mm-hmm. some mm-hmm. screaming need.
I would say two things that, and tell me if this fits with your clinical experience. I would be interested in it as well. One is, kind of groupings turn to hatred when there is a sense of threat. That threat may be the perception that my resources are being taken away, that there are scarce resources in the world or in society, and somebody else is taking away what rightfully belongs to me. It may be a symbolic threat that my values are being overridden by some other people's values. Or it may be self-esteem threat, that somehow my being is less important than somebody else. But whenever this perception of threat comes in, this mere grouping of us and them, I think, begins to go from just something much more antiseptic, if you will, to something that acquires a lot of kind of emotion behind it. It becomes hatred.
I've heard anger referred to as a judicial emotion. It's a reaction to injustice. And that's just what you're describing.
Yeah, it's a reaction to injustice. That's an interesting thing. It's a reaction to perceived injustice. So
right.
Yeah, exactly. So yes, when people feel angry that their values are being trodden over or their resources are being taken away, anger activates all kinds of aggressive acts, especially the most violent ones. So yes, I think you're absolutely right.
So clinically, mm-hmm. what I see is the underpinnings of hatred are fear and vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
which is what happens probably underneath what you're talking about, this sense of injustice. It's about fear and vulnerability, which, you know, that would explain the increase in gun sales after this country elected a black president. And that's what was going on in Germany prior mm-hmm. to Hitler's ascent to power.
Yeah, I think that's so your clinical experience and kind of the social psychological research come together very nicely. That's exactly right, that some events that are experienced as threats lead to feelings of typically either fear, anger, or a combination of both, sometimes disgust, depending on the circumstances. And those kinds of emotions are what we as social psychologists often call intergroup emotions, because they underlie most intergroup conflicts that can go from some event that was a one-time event and that triggers and becomes a much bigger thing and may lead to the examples you give, like the German example, might lead to a big movement.
We talked about belonging and this need to belong to a group. I think back to Frank Mink and many others who join these fringe movements. What happens when we don't get any valuable input as children? It looks like the only guidance he was exposed to was a sense of violence and his environment being out of control.
Yeah, I mean, his story is really kind of the classic story of an example of when this need to belong is violated, because he didn't get it from, as a child, he didn't get it from his family. And he essentially got bounced around from his mother and her boyfriend to his father. That's when he was looking for some other place to belong. And what happened to come along was this exposure to this skinhead group, who in his book he talks about they were the first people who asked about his life, asked about what his school was. And so he kind of attached to them, and that became his people. But he also talked about, in the part of the interview that you aired, he talked about how playing sports in prison with other inmates who were black or kind of multiple races was kind of the beginning of his self-awareness that his beliefs may not be entirely accurate. And so I think sports teams are a good example of a different way to belong, a different team to belong to.
We've been talking about this hunger to belong, and that's what he got from the skinheads, but there was one other thing that he got from them, and you said it. When they asked about school, when they asked about him, they asked about his life,
mm-hmm.
he got what we all also hunger for, and that's compassion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell me who you are as a person. And once we are able to answer that question and then feel accepted,
mm-hmm.
you know, then we found what we experience as home.
That's right. So I think this is where the self-esteem or self-worth is tied in. And unfortunately, the only people he got it from was this kind of local skinhead group. They were the only people who wanted to know about him and his life, and that's probably why they became his community. So I think the need to belong kind of goes hand in hand with who are the people who are showing that they care about you.
We've done a couple of shows over the last couple of months about brain plasticity, an
mm-hmm.
area of tremendous interest for me personally, professionally. So some of your research shows that these biases, big and small, are pretty malleable.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your experience when you put people in a laboratory situation and showed them pictures of successful African Americans and criminal whites.
Mm-hmm. So just to set that up, we've, as a field, about 10 years ago, we used to think that these implicit attitudes, how much we like a group or dislike a group, was kind of fixed. We used to think that these were attitudes we developed early in life and that they changed very slowly. And absent big structural changes, that those attitudes kind of stick. And what we can change are our conscious or explicit attitudes, but those quiet implicit attitudes hang around. It turns out that's not true, and this is where the research that I did with my students and collaborators come in, where we found that simple things like the kind of media people watch. So when people see positive media representations of a group that is societally stigmatized, so in one study we showed people these pictures and biographies of famous and admired African Americans, so people who were politicians, social movement leaders, entertainers, all from all kinds of walks of life. When people read biographies and saw pictures of such African Americans, and accompanied by negative representations of typically valued groups, so essentially serial killers who were white, that simple exposure, that simple media exposure in the course of an hour changed the implicit attitudes. So typically, a lot of participants in American society tend to show preference for white Americans and bias towards African Americans on these implicit attitude tests. And what we found is that positive media exposure to admired African Americans completely reduced this bias. And when we brought the same participants back to the lab one day later, without reminding them what they had seen the previous day, they showed the same savings in memory. They still showed reduced bias. So this kind of provided us with initial evidence, which we then followed up with lots of much more real-world study, that shows that the simple exposure to different representations of negatively stereotyped groups can change our implicit attitudes very quickly. So, as you said, in phrasing your question, our brain and our mind is very malleable. We learn and we unlearn very quickly. We just have to put ourselves in different kinds of environments to allow that learning to happen.
Well, my concern is that in this culture, more and more we are doing the opposite. We are putting ourselves in environments that just reinforce our beliefs. So can you suggest anything to us? Take it out of the laboratory and mm-hmm. into the larger culture. Mm-hmm. What can be done to help us really learn about what we don't know about?
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. The irony of this new information age is that because there are so many sources of news and information, we each of us can choose the kind of information we want to listen to, whether it be accurate or not, and hence we can just simply be reinforced, and our attitudes can be reinforced. I mean, I think the times in life where people are most likely to their attitudes are most likely to change are big life transitions. So going to college, when you're around lots of different kinds of people, after high school or after a neighborhood that may be much more homogenous, or starting a new job where you have no guarantees that the people in the workplace share your beliefs and values and so on, moving to a different city. I think those are the kinds of situations where one choice opens us up to a community of people who are very different, and with it, different attitudes, different values, different information that I think change us in fundamental ways. The problem is that it doesn't happen very often unless we choose to put ourselves in those environments.
So the way to deal with our own personal prejudice is to make these choices, to put ourselves in environments that are different from the ones we are most comfortable with. And I would suggest to you that something as simple as asking liberals to watch Fox News and conservatives to watch MSNBC. That would be a beginning.
That would be a beginning. It would be even better to have liberals and conservatives and everybody in the middle have opportunities to talk to each other. But short of that, yes, I think watching each other's media could be useful. The one caveat to that is sometimes there's research showing that sometimes when people are exposed to information that is completely different from what they believe in, it gives us an opportunity to practice, to inoculate ourselves, to practice why we believe what we believe and why they, whoever they are wrong. So I think there's, it can't be perhaps quite as extreme as people encountering information they absolutely disbelieve. But perhaps something somewhere in the middle, encountering information that is somewhat different from what we typically hear.
Well, I wish that for the world, and I want to thank you so much for your research and for taking the time to join us today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, for me too. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's show. Our guests have been Nilanjana Dasgupta. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts who studies intergroup relations and the way social behavior plays out. We also heard from former skinhead Frank Mink. His new book is called Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. Richard Cohen runs the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has taken on some of the nation's most violent white supremacist organizations. Well, if you've got a question, show idea, or comment, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Gita Simons and Stephanie Marutis produce the show. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.